From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, China's intimidation of Taiwan. We look at what's driving this provocation and how the U.S. is responding with scholar Orville Schell, vice chairman of Human Rights Watch Asia. Also, separation anxiety in dogs. We feature part two of our interview with Dr. Nicholas Dodman, author of The Dog Who Loved Too Much. Ed Ward continues his look at the Austin, Texas music scene, where the South by Southwest Music and Media Conference has just begun. And linguist Jeffrey Nunberg remembers when even squares began to use the word cool. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton has arrived in Israel for a one-day visit. The trip is intended to demonstrate American support for Israel in the wake of four suicide bombings that have killed 62 people.
The United States stands more strongly than ever, shoulder to shoulder with Israel. We will work with you as you strive for a secure peace. We will stand by your side until Israelis come to know that peace with security within this land is a reality.
Mr. Clinton traveled to Israel after attending an international summit against terrorism in Egypt. The gathering didn't yield much in concrete results, but attending world leaders created a working group to seek more specific solutions to the problem of terrorism. China has launched a fourth live missile in its military exercises near Taiwan. The United States continues to monitor the war games via a battle group stationed off Taiwan. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from the aircraft carrier Independence.
Standing aboard the massive carrier Independence, there is not much to see with the naked eye except water, but an intense surveillance is being conducted from a battle group led by the Independence that includes a destroyer, a frigate, a cruiser, and a submarine. The Independence is currently positioned east of Taiwan. It will be joined by a second battle group led by the nuclear-powered carrier Nimitz. This U.S. armada has been assembled in international waters off Taiwan's coast in what is being called a routine operation. But Washington is also attempting to send an unmistakable signal to Beijing that its campaign of intimidation against Taiwan in advance of next week's presidential election will not go unbridled or unnoticed. This is Julie McCarthy reporting.
The Liggett Group, the maker of Chesterfield and Eve cigarettes, has agreed to settle a major class action lawsuit by smokers. NPR's Vicky Quay reports.
The class action suit was filed on behalf of as many as 50 million smokers who claim tobacco companies hook smokers by manipulating nicotine levels in cigarettes. Even though dozens of lawsuits have been filed against cigarette makers over the last four decades, the tobacco industry has never had to pay a cent in damages. But if a federal court in New Orleans accepts a settlement, the Liggett Group would pay up to $50 million a year for the next 25 years to fund smoking cessation programs. And it would adopt certain restrictions aimed at preventing minors from smoking without admitting the Food and Drug Administration's right to regulate cigarettes. The Liggett Group is also on the verge of settling lawsuits brought by five states trying to get cigarette companies to pay for Medicaid costs due to smoking-related illnesses. I'm Vicky Quay in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down more than 13 points at 5,570. This is NPR. A powerful governor in Mexico has resigned in a major victory for human rights activists. There'd been an outcry over an alleged cover-up of his role in a massacre of peasants last year. NPR's David Wellner reports from Mexico City.
It's not clear why the pugnacious governor of Mexico's Pacific Coast state of Guerrero suddenly decided to quit. Rubén Figueroa had earlier vowed he'd stay in the governor's palace for the 3 years left in his term. It appears, though, that fellow members of Mexico's ruling party, including Mexican President Ernesto Zedillo, pressured him to leave. The massacre by state police of 17 peasants last June, who were on their way to an anti-government rally, has tested Cedillo's commitment to establishing a rule of law in Mexico. The now former governor was recently exonerated in slaying by a special prosecutor, but last week, Cedillo ordered Mexico's Supreme Court to reopen the case. Opposition groups are demanding Figueroa still be prosecuted despite his resignation. 38 policemen and 6 top state officials have been arrested in the case. I'm David Wellna in Mexico City.
A spokesman for General Motors says there's been slight progress in the talks to end a strike at 2 brake plants in Dayton, Ohio. But he says there's still some way to go on the main issues. A round of talks ended just before midnight last night, and there are more sessions today. The union says not a lot was accomplished. Some 2,700 United Auto Workers started the strike March 5th. They're concerned about outsourcing the production of parts at other plants or companies. Republican presidential hopeful Steve Forbes renewed his call for a simple flat tax today. He spoke in Washington and referred to his campaign in the past tense. He was asked if he'll end his White House bid, but he firmly said no. Forbes does acknowledge that Senator Bob Dole has a strong lead in the race for presidential delegates, but he's insisting he'll stay in the race at least through next Tuesday's primaries. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. Last week, China fired 3 unarmed missiles into international waters near Taiwan. It was the first of several military exercises, including practice bombing runs, surveillance flights, and formation drills that the Beijing government has conducted in the past few days. These maneuvers have dramatically escalated the historic tensions between these two governments and raises questions about the possibility of conflict in the region. China and Taiwan have a shared policy of reunification, but after years of pursuing separate domestic and foreign policies, and with China's recent provocations, the future of One China is in doubt. As the standoff and saber-rattling continues, the United States has positioned warships off the east coast of Taiwan. We invited China expert Orville Schell to join us today to put this confrontation into a historical context. He's vice chair of Human Rights Watch Asia and the author of several books on China, including Mandate of Heaven and Discos and Democracy. I asked Orville Schell what message he thought that China was sending to Taiwan by its recent military actions.
Well, I think they're extremely concerned lest Taiwan be drifting further and further away from the long-promised hope of reunification of what leaders in Beijing called the Sacred Motherland. And this is indeed, to them, a very sacred task. It is, after all, the primary task that all new dynasties throughout history in China have undertaken. And I think as Mao's revolution implodes and all of the things it once stood for begin to be canceled out by economic reform, one of the things the party can point to and with which it can justify its unilateral one-party rule is that it has reunified China. And indeed, Hong Kong comes on board in 97, Macau in 1999, the Portuguese territory. It already has Tibet. And Taiwan is the last errant piece of real estate that is still beyond its control. And thus it becomes a task of some urgency, particularly for this present regime, which hasn't got a tremendous number of other issues around which it can galvanize its people.
Well, looking inside China, China's leader Deng Xiaoping is 91 years old. Is his age and possible imminent death at part what's driving this policy inside China?
I think it is. Again, you have to recall that China is presently beset by a whole host of, almost insurmountable problems. A population that grows by 15 to 17 million people a year, inflation, the largest migration in human history of what's known as the floating population, peasants moving into the cities looking for jobs, massive corruption, ideological bankruptcy of the party. And so what it really needs is some galvanic force which it can sort of collect up the nation. And this is a terrific occasion. After all, Taiwan, it is internal in a certain sense, which means that China can demand that others stay back. But it also is sort of foreign, which means they can export people's attention offshore. They can create some sort of a diversionary tactic, which will both galvanize people together and also distract them from some of the very real problems that are ballooning up as a result of the high-speed economic reform measures that the government's undertaken.
Taiwan is holding its first direct election of a president later on this month on March 23rd. How do you think the aiming of rockets and missiles at China will influence the outcome of that election?
Well, I think that you know, these war games can only alienate Taiwan further. It will not increase the ardor of the people on Taiwan for quick and early reunification. As the President Lee Teng-hui said the other day, he said, you know, we are for reunification. We just don't want to live under communism. So I think in a characteristic fashion, Beijing is once again shooting itself in its foot. If its intention is to reunify, it is in fact alienating. One does not, in a broken marriage, go back to the alienated spouse and say, I love you, and then stick a gun in that person's ribs and say, you know, let's get back together. This is not, you know, basic psychology will tell you that this is not a successful way to woo some alienated member of the family. So, I mean, I think that the costs are very high of this. I also think, you know, China is really paying for its five decades of isolation. And we forget that the leaders who are running China right now were raised up and cut their teeth in a very different intellectual and political climate than that which prevails around the world now. I mean, they grew up during Mao's revolution. The country was isolated, and I think they have a kind of very distorted view of the way the world is put together, the way it reacts to them. Basic public relations sense really seem to be lacking, and they have this yearning for greatness and to bring China back together, but they don't understand that to act as they are is in a sense extremely self-defeating, not only in regard to Taiwan, but in regard to acquiring that image of a great and responsible power, which they yearn so overwhelmingly to accomplish.
Are there economic ties, economic relationships, social relationships between China and Taiwan now?
Yes, they're very, very deep relations. After all, the mainlanders who came over in 1949 still have family back there. There's massive numbers of Taiwanese who go back every year for visits. There's $20 billion of Taiwan investment in the mainland. So there are not inconsequential ties. And it is these ties that this present spate of military war games really threatens. And I think if the Beijing government could simply relax and say, yes, ultimately reunification will probably be possible, they would do a lot better. But of course, what they fear is that Taiwan will become more independent and that, in fact, I think they're deeply insulted in some way they cannot actually articulate. Of the idea that Taiwan spurns them as an illegitimate government, that communism has in effect failed, which is why Taiwan does not want to return to the motherland. And they take this as a great insult, and it is raises the question of face, which is always very prominent in every negotiation that goes on with the Chinese mainland.
Why would Taiwan, which is a relatively prosperous country, want to ally itself even more deeply with China that has deep economic problems, certainly an increase in prosperity in that country, but because of its sheer size, filled with enormous problems? What would be in it for Taiwan?
Well, I think very, very little except economics. And presently, Taiwan has exported a large number of low-end industries, polluting industries, and even some large-scale industries to China because labor is inexpensive. The environmental regulations, which are getting stricter in China, can be circumvented. So there is a certain symmetry there. Taiwan has technological know-how, capital, management skills, and the mainland has a vast workforce. It has a certain amount of natural resources, and it has, you know, complements Taiwan very well. But other than that, I cannot see a political convergence happening very quickly.
What if Taiwan declares independence? What then?
Well, this is precisely the problem. If Taiwan declares independence, China will find itself to have been painted by its own leaders into a corner where it will have to do something or it will lose immense amounts of face. And this is precisely the danger, that as the rhetoric gets steamed up and as everybody gets pushed into a corner, that something will force the mainland, as a matter of honor, to do something even more provocative and even more dangerous than it's already done. My own view is that Taiwan has been extremely sensible in all of this, and that I think after the presidential election on March 23rd, there probably will be some negotiations. I mean, Taiwan doesn't want war either. They'll probably cool things off a bit. But again, all of these negotiations, one has to make it appear as if China is not yielding, losing, giving in, because it is this age-old sensitivity to appearing to be weak, particularly in this era where all leaders in China are trying to be strong with the succession struggle of Deng Xiaoping's post-death era happening. This sort of exacerbates the question of whether China can be reasonable without appearing to be weak and soft.
Do you feel comfortable at all making any kinds of predictions about how this confrontation will get resolved?
Well, I think we will not have war. And I think the United States has at last drawn a kind of a line, you know, albeit in the water, and with two aircraft carrier groups, the Nimitz and the Independence, which are steaming into the area of the Taiwan Straits. I think it would have been much more salutary if early on the United States and, I might add, other Western powers and Japan, which have been very loath to criticize China because of business interests, had drawn some lines and operated on the notion of, perhaps we could call it tough love and diplomacy, because China actually acts quite well when it knows that it cannot transgress a certain line. And I think the history of the past few years has been that China has pushed and pushed and pushed, and the West, Japan, and the United States have almost always yielded. And this has really, I think, gotten China into some very bad habits. The idea that if it pushes hard enough and throws enough tantrums, that the West, to quote, save the relationship, will finally be the one that will make concessions so as not to have the kinds of precipitous incidents arise that we see right now.
Well, I want to talk about U.S. policy towards China and Taiwan, but first we're going to take a short break. And my guest on Fresh Air today is Orville Schell. He's vice chair of Human Rights Watch Asia and has spent many years writing about traveling through Asia. His latest book, published in 1995, is called Mandate of Heaven. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is China scholar Orville Schell. Does the United States have a coherent policy towards China and Taiwan as you see it?
Well, I think we can say that in certain sense, what is happening now in the Taiwan Straits is a result of the murkiness of China, of the United States' policies towards China. On the one hand, we've stressed, and I think rightfully so in a certain way, the need to keep engaging China, to not push it to the margins and really allow it or force it to become an outside and possibly renegade power. On the other hand, I think our liberal sensibilities have really not served us well in regard to China. Americans And to their credit, I might add, you know, we're problem solvers. We want to work it out. We want to find a compromise. You know, you give a little, I'll give a little. Let's trust each other. Let's get this resolved. It's almost kind of marriage counseling, a kind of an attitude towards things. Well, this has not worked in relation to China. I think that traditionally speaking, Chinese notions of strategy don't encompass this kind of a dialogue very well. They play to win. They will take advantage of concessions and push harder rather than say, you know, say, thank you, we appreciate that, you give a little, now we'll give a little. And so in a certain sense, the United States, I think, has found itself being suckered by the Chinese, who've been extremely adept and very successful at pressing ahead while the United States shilly-shallies around trying to save the relationship. And we all know what kind of a dynamic can set in under such circumstances. What happens is that one side has to bear the burden of saving the relationship, while the other side waltzes off and does whatever it wants. And I think the United States has fallen prey to that syndrome in a way that has not helped us let China know that there are limits, and you cross these limits and there will be real consequences.
Do you think part of the uncertainty in our policy is the sort of, I guess, disconnect between human rights issues and economic development? On the one hand, of course, the business community is seeing all sorts of economic opportunities within China, and those in favor of human rights, of course, being very concerned about the lack of human rights within China.
Well, there's definitely a contradiction. I mean, we have huge economic interests in China, you know, unlike Iran, unlike Cuba, where we can take a more sanctimonious posture and not threaten real interests. But I think, you know, we also need to examine the proposition lofted about frequently by businessmen that open markets ipso facto equal open societies, and that if we just keep trading in China, ultimately we will, things will just turn out. In a certain sense, that may be true. In a long-term sense, I think one can make that case to some degree. In a short-term sense, I think it's not true. And we see evidence of it everywhere. Open markets have not led to a less repressive society in China. They have not led to greater freedom of expression. In fact, in many ways, we find markets having a very conservatizing effect, certainly bolstering the Chinese Communist Party's grip on things. But also, we must remember that markets have their own imperative, that there are many things that markets don't like to hear about, let's say on the media. We see this in our own country. So that it's a bit facile, in my view, just to say, send in the businessmen and everything will come up roses in due course. I think if the United States is serious about its role as, you know, it's sort of those Wilsonian ideals that have made it really the beacon of free thinking and democracy for this past century, then it really has to have another component besides just letting businessmen trade. And this is where foreign policy runs right into the question of human rights, of nuclear proliferation, of selling missile technology, all of these things which China has done. And there has been no effective way to bring it to heel in these matters.
Is there a danger in dealing with China and in repudiating its policies of isolating China and creating a whole other problem?
Well, of course there's a danger of this. And it is precisely this danger, our fear of isolating China or sending it back into some neo-Maoist era, that has given us failure of nerve again and again and again in carrying out our policy. But I think we have to remember that you know, China also has a very profound sense of what it can get away with. You know, if you look back at the classics of negotiation and strategy, there's a wonderful old book from thousands of years ago called The 36 Strategies, which outlines some of the ways in which Chinese should negotiate, or The Art of War is another one. We see emphasis being placed on winning through deception, if necessary, but winning. And I think the second point that it becomes quite evident, and this is also very evident in Mao's own writings, that one never wants to confront an enemy and engage an enemy that is superior. You can bluff them, you can poker face them, you can deceive them, but when push comes to shove, you do not want to confront them. And I think that's what we're looking at in the Taiwan Straits now. So the message there, as far as, you know, to me, is that China knows when it is up against a superior force, and if not unduly humiliated, it will yield because it doesn't have an unrealistic sense of its own interest. And this is very classical.
Let me get you to be specific. If you were then to design a foreign policy for the United States that dealt effectively with China, with all the things going on inside the country and certainly their aspirations for the future, what would that policy look like?
Well, I think the first thing is not to fall into the trap of accepting China on its own terms. I think the United States has to have a kind of a tough love strategy, a realism towards China, which doesn't allow itself to be sort of hectored and bullied, which is in a strange way what is happening, exactly the reverse of the historical experience. I think I could even imagine President Clinton agreeing to go to Beijing to speak with the leaders, to reestablish a dialogue, but only if he had a clear sense of what he wanted to say, and if he would say it loudly and clearly, and wouldn't be so wary and worried about offending them in every in a great variety of different ways. I think it's this lack of inner conviction and inner clarity in our foreign policy that allows the Chinese to manipulate us in ways which we hardly are aware of.
Do you think human rights should be the cornerstone of U.S. policy towards China?
I don't think human rights should be the cornerstone, but I do think that it is in the tradition of the United States to be concerned about this thing, about this issue. And this is why people all over the world, I think, turn to the United States with a certain respect. And I'd like to see us also try to bilateralize it as much as possible. It shouldn't be just us in facing the world with businessmen from every other country moving in behind us when we sacrifice ourselves to this kind of a principle. And I'm not sure that the United States has really made the kind of efforts that I would like to see it make to galvanize some greater international consensus, not just around the question of China, but around other countries as well, which have similar kinds of human rights abuses.
Orville Schell, thank you very much for joining us on Fresh Air today.
Always a pleasure.
China expert Orville Schell is vice chair of Human Rights Watch Asia and the author of several books about China, including Mandate of Heaven and Discos and Democracy. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Does your dog follow you around all the time, hate to leave you, destroy things when you're gone? Well, you could have a dog with separation anxiety. Coming up, part two of our interview with Dr. Nicholas Dodman. Also, part two of Ed Ward's look at the Austin, Texas music scene, and linguist Jeffrey Nunberg on a slang word that emerged from cool jazz. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. The death of saxophonist Jerry Mulligan earlier this year set a lot of people reminiscing about the early days of cool jazz in the 1950s. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, recalls that period and the special word it gave birth to.
I was about 11 or 12 when I got my first LP record from a friend of my parents who liked jazz and had found out that I was taking saxophone lessons. It was called Konitz Meets Mulligan, and it featured the two saxophonists plus Chet Baker on trumpet and Joe Mondragon on bass. I haven't heard it for 30 years or more, but I can still sing all the solos on Too Marvelous for Words. It was pretty amazing, not at all like the Bluebells of Scotland, which is what we were rehearsing for the school band. The liner notes said that what I was listening to was cool jazz. I'll say it was. There were lots of white kids back in the 50s who learned about cool from Jerry Mulligan, whether from his own playing or from the arrangements he did for other musicians, especially the epical Birth of the Cool LP that Miles Davis recorded in 1950. That was just about the time that the superlative use of cool first surfaced in the mainstream press, though it had been around in black speech for at least 20 years before that. An article in The New Yorker in 1951 explained to readers that cool is the current word for hot in musical terminology. The midwife of cool was the hipster, the figure exemplified by Chandler Brassard or Lord Buckley or Lenny Bruce, not to mention lots of wannabes who sedulously practiced snapping their fingers on the upbeat. This was the figure that Norman Mailer described in a famous essay called The White Negro, which presented the hipster as an urban adventurer, a new phenomenon in American life. He moves like a cat, Mailer said, slow walk, quick reflexes. He dresses with a flick of chic. Above all, the hipster spoke a new language that, as Mailer put it, gave expression to abstract states of feeling, as in solid, or crazy man, or that cat is really on his groove, Dad. In retrospect, of course, it's hard to believe that anybody ever talked like that in earnest. That's the way slang is, outrageous on the way in, outlandish on the way out. And by all the laws of language, cool should have died a natural death around 1963, along with most of the rest of hipster lingo. It should have yielded to gear and fab, which themselves yielded to groovy and far out, which yielded to rad and boss, which yielded to dope, and finally to hot again. Who'd have figured that cool would survive the decade, much less the century? Some people claim that cool has never been out of favor. As an architect friend of mine put it, cool is eternal. Others assure the word was out of fashion and then revived. Actually, they're both right. That's always the way with retro. Sometimes it's hard to tell who's just bought that furniture and who's had it all along. Over the last 40 years or so, cool has undergone an almost constant series of revivals and redefinitions. The hippies picked it up in the 70s and spun off a new antonym, uncool. A decade later, the surfers renewed it in the expression way cool. There's the rap cool of performers like Kool Moe Dee and Coolio. And finally, there's the cool of the digital age. Click here for cool stuff or today's cool website. I call this one terminal cool. It has its own special pronunciation where it becomes a muffled grunt of approval. Cool. Cool. I suppose this is Mailer's vindication. Every time cool is reinvented, the hipster makes a flickering reappearance in American life, and maybe never so imminently as now. It's of a piece with the revival of the goatee and the Gap ads that say Neil Cassidy wore khakis. And when you think about it, the hipster is a perfect model for the 90s. Quietly disaffected, mordantly ironic, still working for Time Inc. and writing a novel on the side. In 1957, Mailer estimated that there were 100,000 hipsters in America. Now you'd be hard put to find that many squares. Is everybody cool here? Solid.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Coming up, part two of our interview with dog expert Nicholas Dodman. This is Fresh Air. Separation anxiety and obsessive compulsive disorder are diagnoses we normally associate with humans. But there's a growing body of research in the field of animal psychology which indicates that dogs can suffer from these conditions as well. My guest, Nicholas Dodman, is a professor of behavioral pharmacology at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine and heads the behavior clinic there. His research examines the effects of drugs like Prozac on intractable behavior problems in dogs. Dodman's new book, The Dog Who Loved Too Much, illustrates his approach to dealing with problem animals. Yesterday, Nicholas Dodman talked about canine aggressiveness. Today, we'll focus on fears and repetitive behaviors like obsessive tail chasing. Let's begin with Dodman's description of separation anxiety in dogs.
The dog should probably have four or five of the following signs and situations accompanying the condition. One of the situations would be that it would be obtained later in life by the owners. It would not be owned from the age of 6 or 8 weeks. It would probably be acquired later. It may have come from a pet store or a shelter or a pound, say acquired at 5 months or a year or 9 months, might have been through several different owners' hands. It becomes entirely bonded to the new owners, stuck like glue. Sometimes I refer to them as the Velcro dogs. They follow the owners around the home, is one cardinal sign. They look anxious when the owner goes to leave. They whine or bark, vocalize, usually within a half an hour of the owner leaving. If they want to play a tape recording, they can catch that in their absence. They oftentimes refuse to eat in their owner's absence, so-called psychogenic anorexia. The most common presentation, which owners are really have their attention focused on, is when they destroy property in the owner's absence. So they come back typically to find the windowsill or the door chewed on or the molding around the door. It's usually in attempts to escape, so-called barrier frustration. A dog may even have urinate or defecate on the floor less frequently in the owner's absence out of sheer terror or panic of being left alone. It thinks the owner's never going to return again. And, of course, these dogs, when the owner finally does turn up, they're so relieved to see them that they bounce all over them. There's an exuberant greeting lasting, 5 or 10 minutes or more. I mean, it's just above and beyond the call of duty. So all of those signs, and if you had like 5 or 6 of those signs, then that would be grounds for diagnosis.
Well, you described some of the symptoms of separation anxiety, and I'm sure many people listening are nodding their heads wanting to know, okay, what's the treatment? How do you proceed?
The classical treatment for separation anxiety is what is termed a systematic desensitization program with counter-conditioning. And what that means is essentially a very gradual exposure to what it is you don't like, in this case being left alone. If I just, for a second, use the analogy of somebody who's frightened of flying, the worst thing you could do with that person is suddenly put them on a plane and have them flown from country to country. I mean, that would be called flooding, and, oftentimes it's not particularly humane and doesn't work. So a more sensible approach would be to bring that person to the airport one day, make sure they were happy, and then drive them inside the grounds of the airport to the steps of the airplane, walk them onto it while it's stationary. And, what I'm saying is going little bit by little bit, an onion skin layer approach to alleviating the fear. And with the separation anxiety dog, a cardinal part of the program, and actually all of these, is you must never expose the animal to the fear during the program. So the difficulty is separation anxiety treated this way, the dog could never be left alone during the entire treatment program. It would only be left alone for small periods of time, progressively increasing. Perhaps you first would desensitize to you walking to the door, getting your car keys out, opening the door, stepping outside the door, stepping back in, being out for 15 seconds, 30 seconds, and so on. And it can't even be a linear progression, or the dog will find out what you're doing. And you reward it, on the way for correct behavior and remaining calm.
Let me
and this takes a long time.
Yeah, and let me just make sure. Let's say you grab your keys. That would be one of the signals that you might be going to leave. In terms of rewarding the dog, or how would you talk to the dog or behave with the dog in order to try to allay some of that anxiety that they have?
Well, in a more matter-of-factish way. You know, so many people sympathize with their dog. And, you know, actually, I've seen this many times in animals. I've also seen it in my own daughter, Keisha. And the more you sympathize, for example, as you go to leave, the worse it is. So, you know, one of the a very firm piece of advice in any behavior modification program for this condition and the program that I use now, which is called independence training, is that you must minimize fuss on leaving and on re-entering the house. In fact, we advise totally ignoring the animal as you leave for about 20 minutes and for 20 minutes after your return, so that the animal doesn't have to experience what I refer to as the emotional roller coaster of life. You know, if you are sympathizing and you're saying, you know, I'll be back soon, it won't be long, you know, just mummy will be back, daddy will be back, the animal becomes progressively more anxious until eventually when you shut the door, I mean, the whole world caves in. And then on your return, it's the opposite experience. So my program is designed to even out those crests and troughs of the emotional roller coaster.
How would you know if what you're doing is working if you're not home? Is it a matter of setting up video cameras or just checking out the chew marks in the house to get a feeling whether this particular program is working or not?
Well, that certainly can be done. And I've learned a lot of useful information by, you know, having people either rent or buy or a video camera and set it up. And some of the people who, you know, kind of refuse to believe their dog is actually anxious, you know, when it defecates on the floor in their absence only, incidentally. When we take a videotape, it really brings it home to them, you know, the misery that their poor dog is suffering. So I think videotaping, or, you know, a second to that, audio taping is a good way of finding out what's going on in your absence. But, you know, essentially, you know, what's been used as the yardstick in the past is simply whether the dog would, you know, say, destroy things in your absence. This is the primary presenting sign. You know, people phone up and they say, every time I leave, my dog destroys, you know, this, that, or the other inside my house. So once you solve that problem, usually the owners are happy. Not that at that point all the anxiety is completely taken care of. You've just, you know, managed to placate it somewhat.
Let's talk a little bit about the obsessive repetitive dog, or I guess the obsessive compulsive dog. And one of the breeds that's been your particular obsession, that's your word, has been the bull terrier, and they exhibit this behavior of obsessively, or I guess compulsively, chasing their tail. What's at work here? I mean, if you dissect this behavior, what's at work?
It's a complicated behavior, and it hasn't really been totally elucidated yet. We did one study where we showed that a series of dogs had EEG, and that's electroencephalogram or brainwave changes indicative of some partial seizure condition. So there seemed to be some physiological disturbance underlying. We've also shown that a large percentage of dogs in this breed, including perhaps a greater percentage in the affected ones, have a very mild or even moderate degree of hydrocephalus, which is, quotes, water on the brain. Mm. And we've also shown that they respond, you know, more recently in a paper we're just about to submit, to the human anti-obsessional drugs which are used to treat obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, compulsive hand washing, for example, in people. So there seem to be components of disturbances of brain geometry, disturbances in brain physiology, and as an end product, if you like, along with some other signs, perhaps obsessive compulsive disorder, which is basically sort of the untoward and repetitive release of behaviors that are hardwired in the species. And then the behavior is released over and over again. It's like some kind of repressor mechanism has been released. And, you know, oftentimes, even in people, you might find some neurological disturbances along with obsessive-compulsive disorder.
How serious is a problem of dog neglect and dog abuse? And you made mention of the fact that in problems of separation anxiety, oftentimes you can look at puppy mills or look at a very difficult childhood that a dog had. Is that a very serious problem, the abuse of dogs?
Well, I don't know any figures about, you know, sort of physical abuse. I mean, I couldn't tell you about that. But I think a lot of dogs are sort of inadvertently, you know, perhaps abused is a rather strong word, but they don't receive, you know, adequate care in a very formative period of their life. You know, it's very important to pay attention in the early stages. And this is a point. I mean, I don't know the way around this problem, because this is an innate problem with the puppy mill situation, and that is, if you're breeding dogs for a business, no matter how wonderful the operation is, no matter how ethical you are, no matter how hard you try, the dog will be raised with its litter, perhaps in a pen situation, then has to be transported from the center of the country to the coastal areas where all the pet stores and people are. And those sort of really, a sort of lack of socialization doesn't really constitute a form of abuse, but it is certainly an inadequate environment in terms of socialization and getting them ready for the life that they will ultimately follow. So you often do find that there are problems here, and I think it's something we should work hard to try and circumvent and work with people from puppy mills and explain. I don't know whether it would be possible even to do anything about it, because the demand for dogs is greater than the supply from breeders. So in a way, there are sort of necessary, maybe evil is the wrong word, but you know, there's a necessary operations.
Do you think dogs do better living with other animals in their house, whether another dog, another cat, a gerbil, even a goldfish?
I think it depends a little bit on the dog. I mean, my general feeling is yes. I always think that it's nicer if there are... I don't think a fish makes a lot of difference, and I'm not so sure that in most dogs that a cat would be a tremendous help. But I think to have another dog, especially people and other dogs, are a particularly good company for dogs, and I think that is a good thing. But, you know, dogs, like people, have different characters, and some of them are very needy of company, and others of them are really quite quiet and introverted or independent. Dominant dogs seem to be quite independent, but you know, some other individuals might be, you know, quite happy to have another buddy around. So much so that we actually do see depression. I didn't mention that in the book, but well, maybe a little bit. But you do see a frank depression in dogs who are attached to another dog in the house psychologically. You know, they're dependent on each other, kind of codependent, or live a symbiotic relationship, and then one dies. You can end up with a dog who goes through signs which are exactly the same as a human being who's depressed.
Do you suggest as well that if a family basically leaves for work for the day or goes off to school and the dog is left alone at the house, that the radio should be kept on?
I think sound does help to fill the space. I think it's more or less, you know, if you get a little anthropomorphic and you imagine yourself in the same situation, you know, what would be better for you? And, you know, the worst would be a sort of big, drafty, silent house. And the best might be a sort of a cozy, small, snug with some familiar sounds and something to do. And, you know, if you apply that kind of strategy, then oftentimes that can help. So I'm not saying that a dog with separation anxiety should be locked in a crate, but, you know, if you just provide a crate, even if the door's open, and a blanket, sometimes they like to go in there, and you can train them to go in there, and you can give them things to do, like long-acting, chewy treats, things that will take about an hour to fool around with, and to leave I usually recommend not so much the radio, but I have the people make a tape of household sounds, you know, them doing the dishwashing and clinking around, and I have them make this tape and even put it into a loop and just have this going on as if the people are there.
Well, thank you, Nicholas Dodman, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Nicholas Dodman heads the Behavior Clinic at Tufts University School of Veterinary Medicine. His book is The Dog Who Loved Too Much. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Rock historian Ed Ward has followed closely the evolution of the Austin music scene over the last 20 years. This week, he'll be at the 10th Annual South by Southwest Music Festival, a showcase of mostly alternative music featuring unsigned acts. Ed says the progressive country scene might have put Austin on the national musical map, but there had been other musical scenes happening there before folks like Willie Nelson had even thought of moving to town. Here's the second of our two-part series on the music of Austin.
During the mid-60s, Texas had been a hotbed of rock bands, and with its large student population, Austin was a natural market for them. And as the decade got more psychedelic, Austin began to export talent. Among those who stayed were Houston White and his partners at the Vulcan Gas Company, America's first psychedelic ballroom, the one that gave another Austin expatriate, Chet Helms, the idea for the Avalon in San Francisco. The Vulcan presented a number of local groups like the Conqueror, the Hub City Movers, and Shiva's Headband, and from nearby San Marcos, the 13th Floor Elevators.
You're gonna wake up one morning as the sun creeps the dawn.
Led by the unpredictable Rocky Erickson, they remained a local legend well after they burned out. Probably the most seminal performer at the Vulcan in terms of the local scene, though, was an albino guitarist from Houston. Johnny Winter was Texas' answer to Eric Clapton, a psychedelic guitarist who had internalized the blues. He set the style for the next generation of Texas bands, from ZZ Top to the crew that began appearing at the Rome Inn, the One Night, and most importantly, at Antone's in Austin. Fabulous Thunderbirds, featuring the subtle virtuosity of Jimmy Vaughn, were serious bluesmen, and thanks to their patron, Clifford Antone, whose club in downtown Austin was a well-kept secret during the reign of the Cosmic Cowboy, they got to play with the masters. They were the top of the heap, but there were others like the Cobras and the Storm, which featured Jimmy's little brother, Stevie Ray Vaughn. It took Stevie longer to find fame than it did his brother, but when it came with his band Double Trouble, he became an even bigger star. But by the time the record industry had found the Fabulous Thunderbirds in Double Trouble, things were changing again in Austin. Punk rock hit the city in a big way in the late 70s, and there are those today who maintain that bands like the Big Boys and the Huns were among the best American punk bands of their generation. But because the local music business was still not up to speed, most of the bands of this era were poorly documented, if at all. The same can be said for the next generation of Austin bands, many of whom came up at a campus area bar called The Beach, and whose melodic, intense sound was given the somewhat sarcastic title of The New Sincerity by Jesse Sublett of The Skunks, a hard rock band that had played in the punk era. Some of these bands, like the Reavers, got brief national exposure. Probably the most typical were the True Believers. Three guitarists, one a former member of the Skunks, and as many songwriters, the Troubs had just about every misfortune possible befall them, including a brilliant follow-up to their poorly produced first album that got caught in music business wrangling and didn't see the light of day for 8 years. By then, frontman Alejandro Escovedo had mutated into, what else, a singer-songwriter. Today, the Austin scene supports everybody from aging cosmic cowboys to scabrous punk rockers to such unclassifiable weirdos as the Horsies. The city still doesn't have a really viable music industry, but the Chamber of Commerce is probably right in dubbing it the live music capital of the world.
Ed Ward currently lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's interviews are produced by Alan Tu and Naomi Person with Kathy Wolf and Joan Tui Westman. Research by Rena Bander. Our intern is Nate Hardy. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. From my feelings, she's so dry. Train of thought just left town. Let me stare at the track. Train of thought just left town.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Rhino Records, presenting the 3-CD box set People Get Ready, The Curtis Mayfield Story, highlighting work with the Impressions and as a solo artist. This is NPR, National Public Radio.